So klingt frische Musik. Und so klingt frische bei Aldi. Immer gut, immer günstig, immer vielfältig. Kurz gesagt, frische für alle. Zum Aldi-Preis. Diese Woche rote Tafeläpfel aus Deutschland. 2 Kilo für nur 1,79 Euro. Oder Mini-Roma-Rispentomaten 300 Gramm für nur 1,11 Euro. Entdecke viele weitere Angebote zum Aldi-Preis. Und weiter geht's mit frischer Musik für jeden Geschmack. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Welcome to the first episode of the new Those Conspiracy Guys True Crime.
Yeah, if you listen to this in like 2020, then you probably don't realise it was the first episode.
Yeah.
It was
the first one of its format.
Twas.
We are Those Conspiracy Guys. I'm Gordo.
I'm Paul.
And for this one, there's only going to be two of us. It's going to be about 60 minutes long. Hopefully not too much longer. Mm. And it's a new format of Those Conspiracy Guys where we're going to take on a true crime case and talk about the details of it.
Mm. Shorter subjects than our usual fare.
Yeah. Not so deep. Not so wide.
Mm. You got to go that way sometimes.
And
makes you feel special.
We go through the elements of a true crime case, give our own little spin on it, and tell everybody what we think. And then hopefully later on we can throw up some articles to do with it and make some YouTube videos as well. Mm. So there will be little audio interspersions, if there is available, from news reports, from, you know, case interviews and stuff like that.
Depending on eras, like if you're talking about the murder of Julius Caesar, there's not a lot of audio for that.
This one there's probably not going to be either because it's from over 120 years ago. But in this episode we're going to talk about H.H. Holmes, which was unofficially known as the United States' first serial killer. Mm.
And possibly the most prolific of them all.
Yeah, unofficially.
Unofficially.
So tell us, Paul, who is H.H. Holmes and what did he do?
H.H. Holmes was a madman, I guess.
Or maybe he was a super smart man.
They're not mutually exclusive, I believe. Yeah. I think, unfortunately, most of the really mad ones are terribly clever.
I know.
Mm. But he was a... I don't know. I think we're talking about like the late 18th century.
Yeah.
So like 1890s onwards kind of thing. That kind of period of time turning into the 19th century. He's kind of a classic person of that time in that he's a grifter and a con man.
A snake oil salesman.
Yeah, he's a doctor. He's an entrepreneur. He's kind of a lot of things. He's a charmer.
And
he's
killed a bunch of people.
He's a ladies man. And he's an insane homicidal mass murderer,
and I hear he's got hotelier
friends.
As well.
He's got a family. He's got kids.
Yeah,
he's a very talented hotelier. he's a little bit of everything, which I guess people were in that time. You could kind of it was a lot. You didn't have like one career. People maybe it was a lot easier to as the times moved.
Yeah, to shake and move.
Yeah, I'm a lamp oil salesman today, but tomorrow I'm going to be a horse tanner. But the next day after that, I'm going to be a thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like a Dungeons and Dragons session.
Yeah,
you're just like, I don't want to be a thief anymore. I'm now a warrior.
Yeah, you just hop on a train, head to another part of the country. Leave your old murders behind. Go find some new people to murder and go be a new person, new job, new name.
Just keep moving on. Like hit the little hobo.
So in many ways he's an enigma.
Yeah, I heard he made a hotel that American Horror Story loosely based there.
Oh really? I haven't seen that. That's one of the, which series is that? That's
the fifth one?
The fifth one.
Yeah, where Lady Gaga is like, I don't know.
It's called Hotel. Stuff. American Horror Story Hotel.
Yeah, I think that's the one. And
that's clever.
Yeah, in his hotel he had loads of great torture rooms and great great body slides.
Like,
and
great in the sense of, let's go with like the really archaic sense of the term of like big.
Yeah.
Not saying like brilliant.
But they were brilliant at the same time. Yeah, it's like Pat Sharp's funhouse of murder. Whole lot of fun.
We'll go to the start then. We'll start with the...
Yeah, let's go back and talk about H.H. Holmes. If anything crops up in this episode that you think you might want to talk about, or we touch on something that you think we didn't 100% get into, or we went more than 100% and should dial it back a bit. You can get us on social media. We're on facebook.com/thoseconspiracyguys. We're on Twitter at @tconspiracyguys. We're on Instagram at @thoseconspiracyguys. And we're on basically everything else. If you like this show or you like our longer episodes and you want to support the show, you can go over to patreon.com/thoseconspiracyguys and throw us a dollar. The people at Patreon are making this show happen. And thanks very much for that. And basically, you're only listening to this new type of show because of them. We'll hopefully release one of these types of shows every 2 weeks in the off week from when we release the bigger shows. Now, this time, they're going to be released pretty much at the same time, because on Monday or Tuesday when we release this, hopefully, you've been sent here from Spin FM. And Lauren over at Spin has graciously allowed us to come on, and we do a little 10-minute slot every couple of weeks. And she
very nice
people,
of allowed us to sync it up with this.
Yes, surely. So welcome if you're coming from Spin FM, and that's in Dublin, Ireland, by the way, for those Americans. And yeah, so let's get into it. H.H. Holmes.
Yes, or well, let's start with a man named Herman Webster Mudgett.
Who's that then?
That is one and the same. He begins days as Herman Webster Mudgett.
I can imagine why he changed it to H.H. Holmes, because it sounds way fucking cooler.
You don't like Herman Mudgett?
Hi, Mr. Mudgett.
You don't think that's a cool name?
Hi, Mr. Mudgett. That's an anathema that you got there.
Yeah, that's a pretty shitty name.
Yeah, it's shite.
Yeah, he was born in 1861 in Gilmanton, New Hampshire.
Oh, it's much, much posher than New Hampshire's north east, right?
Yes, but...
Yeah, Mr. Mudgett.
In 1861...
Yeah.
I wonder how posh it was.
It was a bit rural,
then.
I imagine.
What it actually was more probably was just a load of pure descendants.
Yeah, a load of English and Dutch settlers.
Methodist English settlers. You know the sort, the buckle on shoe people. The
buckle on shoe, buckle on hat.
Buckle on shoe, keep the pants buttoned.
But there is a buckle. So the buckle people, he was born among buckle people, Herman Webster Mudgett.
Yes, he was born into like
best names, man.
A large family, a farming family, like directly descended from Mayflower people. Puritans, his parents were stern Methodist people.
That'll make a murderer.
They insisted all the sheets were itchy. And that no one ever touched their genitals, even if they were dirty.
Ah, that is the worst. Ishy sheets and no, and God's wrath if you scratched it.
And smelly bits. Good God.
Terrible.
And this was the life, I guess, that he wanted to run away from.
Yeah.
This kind of came to me. He also
described to get away from it.
He described his father as a violent alcoholic. So, again, you're really painting the picture here of someone who wants to not be there.
You have to think at that time as well, like, 1870s. We all know the 70s was a wild time. And the 1870s was the same amount of wild, but you're talking about like the guys in New York City who are like building all the buildings at the time and coming along and going, hey, you want to buy that Brooklyn Bridge? Like this guy is in New Hampshire, which is quite rural, I imagine, at the time. It's like upper class now, but like a rural background.
Yeah, farming land.
Kind of separate from people. I wouldn't imagine there was like a big schoolyard. There wasn't many school kids. It wasn't like a city life.
Yeah, and I imagine they didn't mix very much. They weren't Mudgetts. Quite those Pennsylvania Dutch. What do you call those? The Amish. They weren't quite Amish.
Yeah,
but they were fairly closed off.
Amish
imagine.
Seem pretty happy to be closed off.
Yeah, they don't seem to mind.
They're never on Twitter.
But it's never good not to mix.
Yeah, I guess so.
Come on, folks.
But from my research, I saw that Herman Mudgett was a bit of a recluse.
A recluse.
So if you're out in the country and you're four people in the school. I know in Ireland, you have three classes jammed together of like four kids. There's 12 classes spread over 3 years. In New Hampshire in 1861, I mean, if you knew how to read, you were probably doing well, right?
I would imagine so, yeah.
Well, Herman Mudgett was a bookworm.
Oh.
And he did very well in school.
Oh.
And
Yeah,
but in doing so well,
they get really smart.
Yeah, at lunchtime and maybe after school, instead of like playing with a hoop and a stick, he would kill and mutilate small animals.
Oh, that's what I was worried about.
And he would pin them up, like we see those Korean and Japanese, the frogs that are put into these like strange poses. I'll see them on Instagram, or you'd see them on your iPhone wallpaper app, and the frogs are all like, yeah. Really, what's after happening is they're after pinning them with giant pins to like a piece of velvet, and then like photoshopping out the pins. So those animals died in horrible agony. Oh. And that's what Herman Mudgett used to do with small animals that he would catch himself. And in fairness, like, that's ingenuity of itself. Like, it's like, well, I finished that book. Computer games haven't been invented yet, but yet I want to experience the death and destruction
something
of
visceral.
Something like Grand Theft Auto.
Yes.
So, like, yeah, let's kill some little animals, which is a red flag.
It is a red flag. I think a lot of the psychopaths of history have started, got their bones or their chops, I'm not sure which, or maybe both.
Yeah.
You get bones and chops from the animals. From killing small animals.
Well, from being a small animal.
Nailing them to pieces of wood.
Being a small animal killer and a bookworm kind of put him in the Hatley place, and he was picked on, pushed around and bullied by his classmates. Yeah.
Unsurprising.
And he was in a scuffle in a doctor's office, which threw him into one of those, a child's got more bones than an adult's got.
Oh, right.
Kind of skeletons.
Anatomy skeleton.
And he got a bone for the skeleton, as it were. Yeah. He enjoyed the death? I don't know if it was a sexual thing. Oh. I mean, you'd have to ask Herman.
Yes.
But like it seemed like that it was one of those traumas that sticks with you as a young child. You know, where if you grew up in London in the Blitz, you could only have an orgasm when there was an explosion or some kind of weird sexual trigger. Yes.
David Cronenberg's Crash.
Yeah. Nicholas Lyndhurst in Goodnight Sweetheart. He can only reach orgasm if he's time traveling.
Yes.
And so he, like, this fascination with dead bodies.
Yeah.
He, you know, his doctor's office, mm-hmm. 50 Shades of Grey situation.
Oh.
And so he grew up and he aspired to be a doctor because he wanted to get at dead bodies.
He combined pleasure with death.
Mm.
Oh, that's not good.
So
and
doctor,
he's smart. And this is in an era Dr. where Mudgett. Grifters and con men can travel anywhere and do anything.
Mm.
Oh, this is not going well so far.
I mean, if you're a doctor, you're pretty much top of the game. And you're the most wanted man
and
in any town.
Yeah. Most trusted.
So he went walkabout, like the littlest hobo.
Yeah, he graduated high school in 1877 at the age of 16. As you said, he was a bright boy. And he moved to Alton, New Hampshire. So not too far, but a bigger town.
Yeah.
And took up a teaching job at the age of 17. Which, again, I guess we're making the point that if you had good education at that point, it set you out quite apart from most
Yeah, but
other
also
people.
At 17 in 1877, he was probably considered almost middle-aged.
Yeah.
Like, life expectancy wasn't probably that long.
Oh, yeah, I suppose.
Mm.
And he's a country boy up in the bigger town now.
Mm.
Never really experienced much because he's a bit closed off childhood. I hope he doesn't go to a soda shop and see the first girl smile at him and go, "I love you and I want to marry you and have all children with
that
you."
That would happen.
That happens to a lot of country boys.
It's the opposite of what happens now when people, young lads, are looking at porn and they're all like, "Yeah, I need to, 90 women to reach any kind of sexual peak."
We have to be flying, jumping out of a helicopter having sex.
There's something going on in the brains of young people when they watch too much porn.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like a neurochemical condition. They watch porn and then their brain reward, it's like some reptile brain reward system, like a neurochemical reward where it's like, oh, there's another woman, there's another woman, there's another woman. Geez, well done. You've a load of kids on the way. Mm. Reptile brain reward.
Yeah, so, I sometimes think, though, when we did our Joseph Ritzel episode,
yeah,
and this is shaping up not too dissimilar.
Well.
I always think it would be very similar early lives in a way.
Yeah.
The kind of Jim
Herman
Jones,
wasn't
the Charles Manson, they have this pattern of early childhood. But like
childhood trauma is not great for
adult life.
No,
it never seems
to
work out too brilliantly.
Marilyn Monroe, the same.
Oh. But yeah. I remember thinking, like, pornography, if they'd had pornography, instead of all the murders and stuff they did, especially the more sexual predators, they might have ended up just, like, staying in a basement that smells like a swimming pool, and that would have been the end of it.
Just,
you know what I mean?
Living with their mom.
Jerking off, watching porn, not murdering people so much.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of one of, like,
I think long-term
experiment.
Pornography is not the worst thing in the world.
No, I know.
As long as everybody's, like, happy to be involved or whatever, no one's getting exploited, then,
We've talked about it before on the show where, like, people in Japan are now, like, checking out of relationships because they're like,
it's
too much.
Hotels that they live in, like, privately.
Yeah, it's a one-man operation where they come home and it's like, well, I've worked, like, 14 hours in some honourable job. Mm. And, honourable job.
Yeah.
And then they come home and then it's like they spend 20 minutes with their girlfriend that's inside of their Nintendo DS. They, jerk off into a pillow with a woman's picture on it.
Mm.
And then they go asleep and it's like, I haven't got time to have a relationship.
It's a different pillow to sleep on, is it?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh.
Not that I'm saying I wouldn't want one, but I've never.
You wouldn't want to wake up with your pillow stuck to your head.
It doesn't have to have a woman's face on it for that to happen. But at the same time, like, you're looking at these Japanese guys going, like, what's wrong in your life that you feel like you can't get that? And in Italy, the same, like, there's like an all-time low birth rate. So they give people in Italy one day a year off paid from work to go home and just have sex to procreate.
Now, like, Italy?
Nowadays, yeah.
Are we putting out a call to the world to say, if you're potent, or you're fertile, head to Italy.
Head to Italy or Japan.
Have some sex.
Yeah.
Because I think it could be,
like a leftover from a Berlusconi kind of joke law that he made when he was when he was in office. But they go home. And Japan, the same. They're encouraging people to be like, please make more babies, that there'd be no more Japanese people after a while. It's weird though how you'd want to check out. But you can see how a young man like that would have
panda mentality
predilections. And later on when we see what H.H. Holmes does, it's not fully like sexual in nature, but like it does have that psychopathic, unempathetic, slice them up and dice them up kind of mentality. But there is like true murder, there would be some kind of strange young deep-seated sexual trauma there, some weird I think, yeah.
Well, let's just hope this young Herman Mudgett doesn't lose himself in the big city.
Yeah, well, he's in the big town now. He's in Alton,
New Hampshire. Mm. And he meets a Clara Lovering.
Oh, no, did fall in love.
Six months later, they get married. A year later, they welcome a son, Robert.
Oh, his big... 1980. His big glassy eyes in the shake shop, in the malthouse.
Yep. He got caught out.
Hey, Clara.
He, like, rang home. Oh, he said, I'm married and I have a son. They're like, for fuck's sake. You've been there 18 months. I don't believe it.
He's only just turned 18 and he already has a kid and a wife. That's great. Fair play to him.
Yeah, well, he did his best. But to be fair, he has a wife and child support now. He heads himself off to the University of Vermont, but leaves quickly, finds it's not the place for him.
Mm.
Maybe there's just not enough dead bodies around. He heads to the University of Michigan School of Medicine. He graduates from there in 1884. And he has quite a time there.
In Michigan.
Yeah, in Michigan School of Medicine.
Michigan's a rock and roll spot.
He has quite a wonderful time there. He actually invents a sort of a way to pay for his studying, which was quite expensive at the time. And,
I wonder
what
that is. Like, was he doing like a paper round? No, but he's 18, maybe working in a bar, shining shoes. Mm-hmm. What was he doing?
He was running insurance scams.
Ah.
Oh, wait. No, because you add like, oh, an insurance scam. But no, these were morbid, terrible insurance scams.
Like he was like falling in the supermarket or in a store and he's
slipping
like...
Slipping on the grape.
I just fell on your soap flakes. They were all over the floor.
There is a pubis in my soup.
He was pulling that kind of stuff, was it?
No, he wasn't. What he was doing was he was taking the bodies that he would dissect.
Oh, for fuck's
in
sake.
His teaching class. He found that...
So he was a medical doctor dissecting bodies in a Michigan university.
Yes.
And he would take the cadavers that he was supposed to be learning medicine on.
He noticed that the school was getting cadavers. They were sort of... Not unreputable. Well, unreputably. They were just buying cadavers off people that would show up with cadavers.
See, it's this 1880s, man. You can get away with shit then.
People would show up and go like, hey, our grandma, dad, or whatever, you want to buy her off us? And then they'd buy them to dissect it. Or someone would just show up and go, hey, I have a dead body from somewhere. You want to buy this?
From somewhere. Do you know what it is?
I found
it.
What are you talking about?
I sometimes you go look at those laws, you know, you see like... Yeah, it's illegal on the anywhere on the 4th of July to carry a chicken under your arm up Main Street.
Must have a bale of hay inside your taxi.
And you know, like, from somewhere, some guy did that thing and it caused some awful occurrence. And then the lawmaker, the judge at the time was like, I'm setting a precedent now that this will never ever happen again, gavel. Like, the crimes that these guys are committing, like this, like a body, like you found a body, is like, you shall not sell a body to a university campus for that section. Yeah. Because, like, people were just like, oh no, I rolled over on the baby. Do you need a baby body? Or something? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I imagine pretty much like that, or two guys getting a fight outside a bar, and one kills the other one, and he goes, I better drag this boy over to university.
Yeah, like, get in a wheelbarrow, like, wheelbarrow sales were up in the roof, man. But I just think, like, in those times, those laws weren't really properly strictly enforced. This is the time in like the West Coast of America where people were shooting each other.
Yes.
And like going out at dawn and going, I challenge you, sir.
It was that age. And you can go, but also there's trains. So at any point you can hop a train and be hundreds of miles away and just be like, now I'm a different person and all the murders I did didn't exist.
And turn off your Find My Friends and one will be able to find you.
Mm. So he notices that there's this weird body trade that's going on in America at the time.
Yeah.
And what he does is he intercepts some of the people selling and picks himself up a few nice bodies.
Mm.
He takes these bodies, disfigures them as necessary, and then he's setting up insurance policies on fake people, on existing people he's who are in on the scam with him, wink wink.
Oh,
he brought a couple of other people in. He would insure their lives, start paying for their policy, maybe $10,000, $20,000, $2,000, whatever. take out these policies with insurance companies, pay the premiums for a couple of weeks, and then place the bodies in maybe a house fire, say there was an attack or a robbery, and that's where the disfiguring would come in, and then report it to the local police, get everything processed, report it to the insurance company, and then receive the payout as the beneficiary.
What a legend. Mm. Like, so this was a pretty, like, I'm only presuming that the insurance game, like that kind of stuff. Like
no computers.
Yeah, a $20,000 policy to pay out for somebody dying. It's probably quite a new invention.
Like they didn't realize someone could be doing something like
that. Monetary insurance. Like, even up until like the 80s or late 80s and early 90s even, there was like check fraud using using the bank, like using those, like, what's it, like the FICA ink, the special ink?
Yeah, changing the checks, the routing serial number or something.
Like,
Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, the Catch the
this
Leonardo
is very
DiCaprio
Catch Me If You Can, isn't it? But like, you know, dark and twisted.
But there's those things like where you know, until somebody does the thing, you don't know that there's a flaw in that system. So someone's always grifting. They're always looking for their gap in the market, going, oh, can I fix that? Oh, can I flick that? Can I do that? Like, this guy was on it in the 1880s.
He seems pretty ahead of his time.
Yeah, man, absolutely.
Except for all the murdering. Because people have been doing that for a long time. He just claimed to be the first serial killer, but first documented. I'm sure there was loads of crazy dudes that never got caught.
So he was bopping around in Michigan.
Mm-hmm. And running his scams, making decent coin now at this stage, because if you think $10,000 is a lot of money in those days, his tuition was only a couple of $100.
So what did he do with all the money? Like, was he baller, just going around with pocket watches? And
he was pocketing, but he was also saving towards the future.
Oh.
Perhaps at this point he already had Fritzl-esque plans to develop some sort of superstructure to house all his murderizing,
so he wouldn't get caught doing it on the street. He's like, I need a play. Ah, what a legend.
He's a sharp fella.
And I guess he was
not
like
to be denied.
He was like satiating his gruesome peccadillo of like chopping up bodies and seeing, like, I wonder what titty meat is made of.
Yes.
Like, I wonder what happens when somebody eats dinner and then they die straight away after eating dinner. What happens to the dinner? Like, I wonder that sometimes. But
a lot of the biographers that talk about him believe that the same sort of mutilating and dissection he was doing on the animals that he was also doing on his cadavers and things.
Jesus, man.
That he was more of a playman than a facts and figures anatomy man, you know what I mean?
Right, he was more of a hands-on, hands-in, hands-up.
He may have become a doctor to play with dead things more so than to learn how to be a doctor and help people.
Now, it seems like when
he
was
never actually did any doctoring.
Yeah, I don't think he's a Hippocratic oath. More of a hypocritic oath. Yeah,
he was sick that day.
So he seems, from what he's read, like, it seems to have moved around a lot.
Yes. He he's qualified as a doctor now, and it was a close run thing. Mm. He was second bottom of his class, and the faculty had to vote twice on him whether or not he'd actually make it as a doctor.
Oh, Jesus.
And I guess in them days, they were like, well, we need more doctors, so this guy's a fucking idiot and doesn't know anything about anything except death and cutting shit up, but
just one old dude with a mustache going, but he is good with a knife. So, like, he pops.
Y'all gonna need someone who can cut someone, boy.
I looked at his list of addresses, and it was like New Hampshire, Michigan, Philadelphia, New York, Chicago.
He moved to a place. I didn't even know there was a place called this. Moores Forks, New York.
Moores Forks.
Yeah, Moores Forks.
Cool.
New York.
And
I imagine people there say it. Moores Forks. Yeah. New York's.
Moose Forks. Where are you from, Moose Forks?
I can't believe there's a place.
Or from the movie Manchester by the Sea, apparently the guys who live there call it Mushta by the Sea. They don't call it Manchester. It's like Worcester sauce, like Worcester.
It's like if our accents had kept developing.
Yeah.
They would have ended up like Boston. Newfoundland. I remember watching like The Departed and going, oh shit, if we hadn't like stopped developing our accent, that's where we'd be.
Yeah.
Or if Ireland like stretched a bit further and people kept moving out west or whatever, eventually it would have sounded like that.
If there's any Americans coming over to Ireland, you will notice as you travel from town to town, maybe not in Dublin City or any of the big cities, but as from town to town, you'll notice there are accent changes with even 3 or 4 miles. Yeah. There's totally.
We have as many accents as any other country in the world, just squeezed into a very small area.
Yeah, like a tribal thing. Definitely.
I think we're joking. I go up to the north of Ireland and go, you're putting that on.
Yeah, and they're like, murder hard, I'm in Harley about it.
You don't talk like that when there's nobody else around. No way.
Oh, those Irish Republicans coming up here. So when he moved to Moose Forks, New York, he's
left a wife and
child
behind.
On the run, right?
Yeah, he's left a wife and child behind. He meets a young lady. She finds out that he's already married, and he's got to make the run from Moose Forks.
Begging me.
Yeah. He's getting, but you can see he's developing his crimes now. He's trying to move into lots of different crimes at this stage.
Yeah, he's really branching out. Like,
he's going with like theft.
He's like the Tesla of murder at the time.
Body corpse mutilation, whatever. Yeah. Crime that is. I'm sure it's a crime.
Selling the Brooklyn Bridge.
Selling, he was probably that guy, just under an alias.
I love it.
Mm.
And so when he's in New York, he's still fucking around with killing people in Jersey, or?
No, I think technically at this point he hasn't done any murders yet.
Right.
Or not that we know of. I mean, like, there was a disappearance of a little boy in the town he lived in. And because he was known as a guy who had a previous history and has a wife somewhere and is trying to clock onto ladies in the town, suspicion fell upon him.
So he's like a man about town with a bowler and a mustache and a shady past. And people are like, that guy's fucking pretty weird. Like, he's giving off weird vibes.
I think people are more
like
used to con men in that era, though, as well.
Yeah.
And, like, everything's like, you know, someone can show up with a piece of paper that's like, this is a signed federal document, but, like,
what the fuck does that mean?
So you're always on your guard against someone conning you out of something, because it could happen all the time, I think.
Sure. I've seen Django. I know the crack. Yeah, that's mad.
Can't tell who anybody is. So he leaves New York. I think maybe the big city was a bit too enclosed from, but also a bit too close to New Hampshire. So he takes himself over to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
The streets of Philadelphia.
And he invented AIDS there.
He did indeed. He had sex with Tom Hanks, and then they created AIDS together.
The actor Tom Hanks plays somebody that has AIDS.
Oh, that's not a documentary.
No.
Tom Hanks doesn't have AIDS.
No, neither does Cuba Gooding Jr.
Oh,
or Denzel Washington. One of them. So he's
Antonio Banderas.
Yeah,
dude, that's
in the guitar case.
That is that wasn't a documentary.
There's a snake in my boots, and I've got AIDS.
He's never a high-priced lawyer.
So he's in New York's.
Mm-hmm.
A little boy goes missing, and it's kind of like, gotta get out of here. Like, that's fucking,
that may have been his first murder,
man. That's very suspicious. So he's fucking around with dead bodies, fucking around with like animals first, then dead bodies.
Yes.
Then he's like, oh, there's this stray child, and he just snatches up the child.
Lucrative insurance scams are the family deals,
right?
Getting one person's good. Having a whole family, a man, woman, child die in a house fire. That's good money. That's tree monies right there.
Brilliant. So he's looking at he's looking to torch up a family and go.
Yes,
I love that.
So it might have been he couldn't find a cadaver of a young boy. He used to complain a lot. Once after he was caught, he complained a lot about having to wait maybe weeks at a time when he had an insurance scam set up to find the right looking body, the right age,
weight, the right age, the right size.
Especially if he was matching it to a real person who he was using to the scam with.
Yeah.
You gotta wait till it looks just like that person.
So do you think he's being approached by someone, some like New York businessman is like, man, actually I've got a wife and she's been cheating on me. But I got a life insurance policy out on her. How about she burns in a fire, if you know what I mean? And you're like, you want me to burn her in a fire? And he has to find a bird that looks like that, you know, tie her up, put her in the thing, burn her in a fire, get the insurance money. Is that the kind of, do you think he's being propositioned, or is it?
I think a bit of both. Like when he was in Michigan and you think he's 18 and he's away with just him and his family, sort of isolated, they've moved. I would imagine he doesn't know too many people. He probably hatched the scam himself.
Yeah.
To a certain degree. But yeah, that's up in the big city.
From like no one's ever done it to, I wonder how many insurance scams I can get away with burning up bodies, man.
Wondering, like when the telephone was invented, how quickly before someone came up with a phone scam? Like 2 days?
Yeah.
2 days? Someone like fucked with someone over the phone almost immediately. And there was only like two phones in the whole country and someone scammed the guy on the other end.
Alexander Graham Bell.
He was fucking with like JP Morgan.
Ahoy, hoy.
He's like, this is your mother, JP. He's like, mama.
What are you doing in the basement with Alexander? So he's in Philadelphia. Little boy disappears and he's off again. And this is where he meets his destiny.
Yes.
He reaches his purpose.
Yes. Life is coming good. He becomes a pharmacist in the Philadelphia.
Right.
And
with his doctor's degree or his PhD, he's going, I can be a pharmacist.
Yes, exactly. But this is, again, doesn't want to help people. I think there's a very clear sign that as a doctor, he never works as a doctor. So he doesn't really care about helping people at all. And again, problems happen in Philadelphia. A little boy gets sick from medicine he gets from Herman Mudgett at this pharmacy.
And they claim an insurance line. He's like, oh, you took too many tablets.
And it turns out Herman was the beneficiary of his insurance policy. No. But the heat's back on him again for another missing boy, or for another dead boy. So Herman Mudgett now, this is the making of
the
man.
That's already red flag.
Because what happens here is Herman Mudgett becomes H.H. Holmes, and a new man is born.
Oh, he has to change his name.
He fakes the death of Herman Mudgett.
Right, to get the insurance. Cool.
And uses that kick and whatever else money he saved. But I'm sure he's going to lots of bawdy houses and spend his money wildly. But he becomes...
making it rain greenbacks.
He becomes a new man altogether. The Henry Howard Holmes, or H.H. Holmes as he prefers to be called. Yes. And he takes himself off to Chicago.
So now my 1890s voice will exactly match the location and not just be a general voice.
That's why you're hearing a Chicago-esque accent.
Yes. Meh. Hey, Chad Chomps, eh, meh. So he moves to Chicago, and he then takes up the mantle of pharmacist again.
Yes, of course. This is what he knows. He doesn't want to be a doctor. He doesn't want to do anything that's going to help somebody.
Right.
So he wants to be a pharmacist, like, so he can steal medicine and pill pusher, poison people.
Milk of the poppy.
Yes. Poison them with something that will kill them 8 hours later and snatch their body before anyone finds them.
I love it.
Use it in a fire for an insurance scam.
You run into his pharmacy at 5 to 6 and he's like, I need these tablets. And you're like, sure you do. Let me just get my coat and give it to them and then follow them home. And then that's...
Or he just gives them the pill. He's like, where are you going to be at 10 o'clock tonight? Okay. Like, no reason.
See you then. I mean...
I mean nothing. Remember to take all of the pills now.
So when he went into this pharmacy, it was Holton's Pharmacy.
Yes.
In Englewood.
Englewood.
In Chicago.
Yes.
And the proprietor...
Yes.
Elizabeth Holton. Mm. Well, the wife of the proprietor, Elizabeth Holton, is a buxom... fine lady.
Oh.
And
this seems a good posting.
Yeah, I mean
he's the pharmacy boy now.
Yeah, he's the gopher. He's
dishing out the pills, but
step and fetch it.
There's Ma and Pa, but Ma's all right.
Yeah. So Mama's all right. She's got a squeeze box.
Ah, Daddy's all right.
And Holmes take they're both just weird.
Yeah.
He fancies her squeeze box and like, does he...
What would you cut do? Her up in bits? I don't know. Husband in the way.
Ah,
what could he do about that?
I don't know. Give him some tablets or anything. You know, tablets? Is that what happened?
Yeah, the husband died.
Oh, for fuck's sake!
And Elizabeth, in all her wisdom, charmed by the man Holmes, sells him said pharmacy.
I'd say there's an element of like psychological manipulation there as well. It's like lull her into like a sexual seduction. Say like she's like, no, we mustn't, and he's like, Your husband. Yeah, your husband's in the way, see?
Yeah.
And then he, you know, just grind this up in his dinner.
Yeah, slip it in there.
Wow. So he now owns this pharmacy.
Yes. He must have had really good references.
Jesus Christ.
I assume he wrote them, though.
Yeah.
But then it's like, they were glowing.
Previous landlord references.
Yeah. Works very hard in pharmacy, killed almost no one. You're like, God, he's good. But again, maybe in them days, though, if your pharmacist didn't... Well, you probably did... accidentally give wrong medicine to people every now and then.
Oh, of course.
It's probably easier to be a pharmacist then.
Hey man, this says 30 leeches on this prescription. You only gave me 24. Come on. Who's holding out the leeches? So he owns the pharmacy now. Mm-hmm. He owns the Holton Pharmacy.
Yes.
And does he leverage that then into the hotel or how
he does? Right. This is where he starts building his money from, really.
Right. So he has a bunch of money from all of these like insurance scams, just pocketed away.
Yeah.
Like in a roll somewhere under a mattress.
Yes, in those days, it was somewhere probably about as personal as like traveling the country.
A4, like $50 bills, like they're the size of copybook pages. Mm-hmm. And then, what, like he sells the pharmacy?
Like he's so sick, he could stuff all his money in a dead gopher's ass, just be confident no one would steal it.
Oh, that's old gophy there. Can't, it's a moose head.
Ain't nobody going to put their hand in there but me.
So does he sell the pharmacy?
He doesn't know. Wait, he does eventually. But
couldn't sell it out from under Elizabeth if she was like...
No. Yes, exactly. Elizabeth is still there. She sold to him, but she's still working there. He begins becoming, I guess, a snake oil salesman. I don't really know how to describe it. He makes cure-alls, which are essentially water. Mixed with
water with cocaine in it.
Yeah, not even cocaine. Water mixed with crapola, and just sells it to people and goes, "This is a cure all. This is very expensive stuff that will like cure your whatever, your blindness." He just becomes a snake oil salesman, a charlatan of the time, and that's where he starts like boosting his finances a little bit,
and working on his spiels,
and exactly working on his salesman technique.
Roll up,
his showman, his entrepreneur sound.
Cool.
And this is where his plan comes to fruition. Then he finds there's a vacant lot across the street from the this pharmacy that he's working in. He decides to buy said vacant lot at 601 to 603 West 63rd Street in Englewood.
And this is the site of the famous H.H. Holmes Hotel.
Yes, the World's Fair Hotel.
Awesome. So at the time in 1893, there's an anniversary of the Christopher Columbus finding the New World, right?
Mm-hmm.
And for 1492.
Yes.
And a year...
Yes, so there's 401.
Yeah, it's a 401st anniversary, and this is going to be the World's Fair Hotel.
Yes.
Themed on all the scientific, you know, advances of the time. Like, we're talking about the time when Tesla is making these special light bulbs and, he's already moved over from Croatia and he's working with Edison and they're racing to get this like light bulb technology. We're talking about a time of great change and a great development in American history.
We spoke in the Tesla
history,
episode, like this period of time, like a lot of shit gets invented that's like useful modern shit that's in everyday life now.
But it's in everyday life, but it was kind of suppressed for a while. Like it, a lot of that stuff could have been invented
suppressed
a lot earlier. And then like, you know, World War One crept around and kind of people were busy for a while. But it seems like the 1890s was a great time of ingenuity.
It was.
And he was able to take advantage of this by hiring on a bunch of hotel builders that would be fired piece by piece, right?
Yes, make this magnificent hotel powered with lights and all sorts of magical things all over it.
And so he's like he's hooked up with Lizzie Holton. Is he? Is she?
Oh no, she's dead.
Oh fuck!
She's dead.
No way.
Why? What is he, like when people started coming and complaining that their snake oil cures weren't working, and like what the name of Holton Pharmacies means nothing anymore, and she comes in and complains. What do you think he's gonna do?
Oh no.
He's got to kill her.
So he's single now. He's like, oh, I'm a single man. I'm coming around. I'm going to make it.
There's always a string of ladies behind him. And at this point, there's also a wife behind him.
So he's got second wife.
Yeah, yeah. Did I not mention that?
No.
Oh, okay. In 1887, he's only 25 now. He becomes a fully fledged bigamist. Steps into another crime. He's really flying now. And he marries his second wife, Myrta Belknap.
He seems like just a shady cunt now.
Yeah.
Like just general shadiness.
Yeah.
But a gentleman criminal.
Yes. Nice. Well, I mean, as gentlemanly as it can be when murdering people.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, but he's quite... Yeah, I guess so, yeah. He's an entrepreneur. He's certainly a charmer. He's certainly charming everyone
seems
he meets.
Like him, it would absolutely. Like an 1890s Charlie Manson.
Hmm. He meets Myrta on one of his trips around selling a snake oil in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And she's all about him.
Yes. He is working on a divorce from the first wife, Clara Lovering, but that never actually goes through.
So she's at home in New Hampshire with a child belonging to him.
Hmm.
I wonder what happened to the child of H.H. Holmes.
Huh.
Did it grow up to be...
Must be. His first son, Robert.
Holmes Jr.
And then he had a daughter with Myrta as well. He had a daughter named Lucy in 1889.
Wow. Mm. We'll have to look that up.
Yeah. Let's and Myrta, like, knew, I guess, like, don't blame her too much. She, I guess, was thinking, oh, he's getting divorced from his first wife.
Mm.
He's a doctor. He's bought this pharmacy. He's a rich entrepreneur. This is all going well. I like this guy. I'm going to have a child with him. We're married. So, like, Myrta's not...
She's all right.
It's understandable how she's getting sucked in at this point, and I'm sure she's not seeing any of the murders.
And he's, like, loaded, like...
And he's loaded. He's doing well. He seems to be a bit of a genius, because he's now bought this lot, and he's building a hotel in preparation in the late 1880s for this 1893 World Fair that's coming.
Right.
That's a good... He's cornering a market there. He's getting ready to go...
He knows the crap. Yeah, and he's branded it and everything.
Yeah,
like.
He goes, like, Chicago's going to be the number one travel-to place in the world in 1893, and I'm going to have, like, a massive hotel in downtown.
So, in this hotel, I watched a documentary that went through, like, they had these 3D models of the inside of the hotel.
Yes.
It seems to be some fucking...
Looked like a castle,
crazy,
right?
Like,
these weird kind of battlement out rooms.
A castle, fun house, you know, a secret room, scary movie type, you know, like, dumb waiters going up and down and slides, like... For bodies into the basement and shit. Like, it's wild.
It's like a Resident Evil, Silent Hill.
Yeah, like all the puzzle
the
boxes
of,
and all that
Guillermo
stuff.
Guillermo del Toro.
Yeah.
Like, pure evil hellhole.
Some Pan's Labyrinth kind of shit.
Yeah, it's like
man.
That kind of fucking trippy shit, but in the form of some kind of Silent Hill hotel.
So give us the specs then of this hotel. Like, we're talking about Fritzl basement type construction. So when
these guys are so industrious, aren't they?
Yeah, man. When, if you want to fucking kill and rape somebody, you
get
gotta,
industrious. You really put
work.
Your back into it. Like.
You gotta work. So he, like with Joseph Fritzl, like he used over a dozen builders to build the separate part. Like one guy to excavate the ground, one guy to like lay the foundation blocks, another guy to lay these other blocks, and then the secret room was built by one builder, and then he was fired. Another one came in to build the next part, and nobody had a full kind of scope of the full project to know to be able to put it together, except one dude, Joseph Fritzl had. Do you remember that one guy?
Yes.
And he was a bit soft in the head.
Yeah.
He wasn't all, you know. He wasn't a full 100 cents. You know what I'm saying? And I presume H.H. Holmes was kind of playing builders off each other and doing like
the exact same process. Yeah,
but 20 times bigger. This huge,
this massive hotel. This three storied hotel with hundreds of rooms.
So what, like, give us the specs of the hotel then.
This hotel that the locals called the castle. Again, if you see a diagram or a picture of the hotel at the time, it kind of had these weird turret kind of bits that came out, and it was very flat. It was like a three square building expanse. Mm. So it did look like a big castle, a big foreboding building. And the locals really didn't like the look of it or the facade of it or the general oppressive nature of the building itself on the street. But the hotel on the bottom floor seemed pretty nice. It had shops, like jewellery shops, all sorts of things. There was a pharmacy, of course. You gotta get your tablet somewhere, right? Of course, you gotta kill people that way. Like, cause that's such a fun way. Like, maybe you wake up in the morning and go, pop a pill, wrong pill, kill a person, yay, walk off. But how do you explain,
like, the USPS arriving at the door with, like, boxes of tablets for mixing up like poisons you're like, where'd you get this Zyklon B from? it's for the pharmacy. And you're like, oh, okay. Do you know, it's a great excuse to have medical chemicals on the premises and everything you need.
Oh yeah,
deliveries. Not if you were having deliveries to a hotel that didn't have a pharmacy in it like that, you'd be like, hey, what the fuck. You know, it's a good idea. That's very clever.
This bottom floor, there's also a conference room, there's a bar. It's like a, you know, general kind of hotel mall lobby kind of thing. Second floor and the third floor where all the rooms are, the guest rooms. And then on the top floor, there's also an office, which is his office, which is connected to a large full-size bank vault.
Wow.
So I guess he thinks he's doing super well at this time. And a powerful large furnace that's on the third floor. What?
To keep the hotel warm.
To keep his office, his upper floor warm, his bank vault. I'm sure that bank vault gets very cold. Yeah. But like proper, when I say bank vault, I mean proper bank vault, like airtight bank vault.
I'll
come into effect later.
I'm gonna put my cards down and say it was the hotel manager in the bank vault with the suffocation. That's my Cluedo guess.
Yes, with bare hands.
With bare hands.
Yeah, oh God.
That is fucked, man.
Erection.
So we can see, like, with a bank vault, a furnace, that many rooms, like, no windows in it. I read that there's another room up near the top of the building that just had a hatch on the top of it.
Yes.
And it was soundproof and... Yes.
Put someone
in there and just let them starve.
Yeah. It was like 10 feet up to the hatch in the roof, so you drop someone in, lock the hatch and...
And that's it.
Yeah. They're having a Lisa Lamb type death.
And then you have a bunch of doors that led to, like, you open it and it's a itchy and scratchy type cartoon wall.
Yeah.
Where you just can't get through it and you're like, oh, bollocks.
There's a brick wall behind the door.
As you're running up a staircase away from a murderous H.H. Holmes in a soundproof hallway that's fit between two other, like, sides of the building that nobody knows is there.
Yeah, yeah, a secret hallway.
You're running away and you're like, finally got to the door. And finally, like, you turn the handle and you pull the door thinking that this is your escape. And there's just a brick wall there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is some fucking grim psychological torture. Like, not only are you going to get murdered, but you also have that flickering glint of the possibility of escape.
Yes.
Until you open the door and it's brick wall. Like, that's fucked.
This guy, in a way, inspired a lot of horror tropes, I guess.
Yeah, man.
His life story.
They always run upstairs.
Running up the stairs, but the stairs leading to nowhere in that sort of, like, trippy horror, like a Blair Witch trippy horror movie kind of a way, where it's like... Like, you go up a set of stairs and it just comes to a dead end.
Like, Silent Hill is a very good analogy. I'm sure that the Silent Hill people got some ideas from those kind of psychological tricks. Like, that's fucking pretty sick.
Freaky shit.
He also used to put people in the bank vault and close it, and then they would just suffocate over a period of 3 or 4 days.
He did, like, his different forms of killing.
Mm.
What was with that?
And also then...
Like, every flavor.
Let's go through. There's torture rooms then, other torture rooms that he had. Like,
yeah, he had 100 windowless rooms that were, like, fucked, not really guest rooms. These were just assorted rooms for doing whatnot. There were 51 doors that led to the brick walls of which you speak.
That is...
Which is a lot.
A ferocious amount.
Yeah. So imagine this hallway, like there's... None of the layout makes sense. None of it kind of matches, so everything's all higgledy-piggledy, so it's hard to tell where anything is.
How do you get a builder?
51 of the doors have nothing behind them.
How do you get a builder to hang a door in front of a brick wall? Or how do you get a builder to build a brick wall inside of an already cut out door? Like I don't know, man.
They must, and you know what,
someone knows something.
If a few of the builders would have worked something, and apparently there were rumors that went around the town, like, you know, obviously, like, during the Titanic building, maybe there was a few rumors that spread throughout the shipyard. Like, here, I'm sure the builders in the taverns afterwards would have said, like, what did you build today?
He's like, you wouldn't believe it. That guy up in that, up in the castle up there, he had me build a brick wall inside of 40 doors. You're like, what?
I built a room full of spikes today. Like, that's unnecessary.
This guy had me testing the place for ventilation. I filled a whole, I smoked 2 packets of cigars up there. Not one bit of smoke got out. Like, that's fucked up, man. Who, like, somebody knows something. There's no way you can have that specificity of murder method.
Well, he did have an accomplice.
Ah.
Yeah. During the building, he meets a carpenter on the site named Benjamin Peitzel. And right. Benjamin Peitzel is a bit of a violent criminal.
I got a guy. Yeah. I got a guy to do that stuff for you.
But on the classic of the time, had hopped a train, moved somewhere else, met someone, got married, had some kids, and now was not a violent criminal anymore, I guess.
So he was like a vagrant hobo that just wanted to start again. But
yes, became a carpenter and set himself up with life. So Peitzel had a wife and five young children that he needed to support. And him and Holmes like kind of immediately hit it off, like some sort of gruesome Mr. Burns and Smithers.
So you think it was kind of like a predator prey? Like he was like,
I think he found this like violent young fella who wasn't clever enough to become like his own serial killer.
Wow.
Or maybe aspired to something like that.
Yeah, a gopher man, a lifter, a body lifter.
And also, but also Holmes was showing him the world of like, I do murders, but I also get rich doing it.
Brilliant.
Think about that.
I've got five kids. Of course I need to get a few bob. And I get to murder.
And I get to kill people and smash things. I love that.
It's a win-win.
Yeah, so these two become sort of inseparable. He becomes sort of the Igor to his Dr. Frankenstein.
Deadly.
Yeah, Benjamin Peitzel is his Igor in many ways. And actually, later, a state prosecutor in the case would say Peitzel was more like his tool or his creature than...
Oh, yeah, I would imagine so.
Than like an accomplice or a partner.
H.H. Holmes sounds like a smart guy. Like, he's not gonna take on someone that he couldn't completely control and keep silent. Like, one word out of Peitzel and it's game over, like, for the whole hotel, you know?
Yeah, he knows all the dirty secrets.
Jesus.
But and then so Peitzel, doesn't that put Peitzel in a precarious position?
Yeah, as well, but, like, I don't know, man. Like, an Igor type...
It's like, if you work for Dr. No as one of the henchmen, but especially on the top level or whatever near his office, you must know what's going on and you must know, like...
If Dr. No goes down, you go down.
I'm going down too. Like, there's no way. Like he has to win, or I'm going down. Like,
yeah. So
Bond will just walk in here and shoot me in the head, and I'll be in the movie for like half a second.
But it seems like Holmes's culpability was like defended by Peitzel. Like he's like, well, shit. Now I have to do it because I'm even a little bit, bit involved.
Tarnished. Yeah, he got
pizza gated. Yeah, I'm a tiny bit involved, and now I have to like fight for my life.
Yes.
To keep Holmes clean.
Yeah.
To make sure
he doesn't get caught, to clean up after him.
It's a mad psychological trap.
To make sure nobody notices what's going on.
So he helped with all the cleaning up of all the bodies mopping up of blood and the...
Exactly. Covered his tracks.
The alibi that Holmes needed.
Holmes was always with Benjamin Peitzel and his family, I guess, whenever a murder went down. But Holmes, so once the hotel opens, Holmes, like, he pretty much begins murdering right away. He in the hiring process. He hires pretty much predominantly single young women. And especially anyone who might have moved to Chicago to find work for the World's
Fair.
They
don't have family and they're living in a shared accommodation with some other girls. And it's like,
they're from
Missouri. Have you seen Mary Lou?
I'm going up to Chicago for 2 years, make a lot of money and come back to town. We'll buy a restaurant or something.
I'm going to the World's Fair, mama. I'm going to make my fortune.
I'm going to meet that Mr. Tesla and marry him.
And then?
It's like, you're not going to marry Tesla.
Oh, Mr. Holmes. Why, surely I need a place to lay my head for the night.
And rich entrepreneur set up in the city of Chicago.
Yeah, like rich man,
charming
nice
man.
Mustache,
nice mustache,
white shirts.
Like not psychopathic looking.
Yeah,
had a Bundiness, a Ted Bundiness about him where it was like, oh, you look like a normal. How the fuck?
They're the worst ones.
Yeah.
So he would kill them then with almost a dozen different types of documented murder methods.
Yeah, he enjoyed many flavors. The rainbow, the Skittles, I believe.
We've talked about then like the bank vault suffocation.
Yes.
We have the 10-foot-tall room with a hatch on the top.
Yes. He had a vent system run into some rooms.
Brilliant.
Where it was a one-way vent system, so he could pump gas from the basement into the system. So he, as you said, he'd take his chemicals from his pharmacy, mix them up in the basement, some ether, some ethanol, some other things.
Chloroform.
And then he heat it up, send it
Links
up through the
Africa.
Vents. That will kill immediately. Yeah. Or Axe Africa. Or Ask Africa, depending on where you live. And he'd send it up through the vent and into the rooms, and people would basically asphyxiate in their sleep.
There's lots of pictures.
But like, he'd murder someone in their sleep, not even being in the room. He wouldn't even experience it.
But still,
he'd just open the room later and see the dead body, and then, I guess, immediately get rock hard.
Well, there's loads of... like pictures, like the caricature depictions and drawings of how he would creep in, and there was all sorts of secret doors behind, like inside alcoves and bookshelves, and he had you know, 51
like
doors
a Harry
with,
school
with
or
brick
whatever.
Walls, but he had a bunch of other ones, like in the Oval Office. You know, you ever seen the Oval Office?
Oh,
and like
yeah.
the cornice or the dado rail, as we call it, goes all the way around, and then there's like a line that's indiscernible from the wallpaper, and it just opens into the hallway. And you're like, oh, so he had a lot of secret doors, and he just like creep in and go over to the bed and be like, oh yeah, you're dead, and then like bounce. Or his Igor Poitzel would come in and pull the body out and then dump it down a kind of a laundry chute of bodies into the basement.
A chute?
Yeah.
Like, what? Like, yeah.
There's like a slight...
Like a laundry chute, but...
Laundry chute from I suppose, a couple of central locations, but they would go down between the walls, like the lads in the first Matrix movie when they're trying to escape the agents.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
just
yeah.
go like... All the way down through the lats, right
down
to the basement.
Into the basement. Oh.
Ah.
And then, so...
Class.
Like, but like, if you were staying in the hotel and you weren't one of the murderers, you weren't one of the murderers.
You'd never know.
But like, you'd walk up to the laundry chute, maybe you'd throw like some my pillowcases down, you'd be like, Jesus, that stinks.
No,
fucking hell.
There'd be no bodies.
People shitting on their sheets and putting them in the laundry chute.
What did he have? Like, he had a furnace. He had
a
massive furnace.
Oh, I see. They're going down and he's incinerating the bodies in the basement. Oh,
Well, what he was doing was, as far as I read, he was satisfying his peccadillo of cutting up bodies. Yeah, so he'd get them down, cut them up, and then sell the organs. This guy is like thrifty.
Oh,
he is thrifty.
Use every part.
Yeah, like the Native American Indians with the buffalo.
Buffalo.
Yeah. So like he cut them up, sell their bones like for skeletons for science labs, I guess, right, or whatever.
Are you saying there's murder victims that could be in like a laboratory somewhere, a teaching school somewhere in America?
Imagine. H.H.
Somewhere
Holmes.
Around Chicago.
There's like a stamp somewhere with home, Triple H on it.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
And they thought they got it from the WWE.
Is there any other types that you found interesting?
Yeah, he had a hanging room, which was essentially a room with like a makeshift gallows in it. You know, kind of you could crank someone up and hang them.
Yeah.
And then he also had I don't even believe this one. He had a medieval stretching rack.
That's a stretch to believe it, but I wouldn't. Like, it's not an undead. Like, that's a terrible way to die. Just
that
getting pulled apart slowly.
Like, I'm thinking, like, oh, God, no one's died like this in, like, 400 years.
But he must have had some massive amount of foresight, like, some genius foresight to know if I'm going to be killing someone by chopping them up in bits or by, like, poisoning them, they're going to be, like, running around the room screaming and you know, clutching at their throat. Mm-hmm. Or if you're stretching somebody...
They're
going to scream pretty hard. Or if you put somebody in a room for, like, 10 days to starve to death, like, they're going to be shouting. He had it all soundproofed. He had it all done.
Oh.
Like... That is like grim evil foresight.
Hmm. But how would he know if someone like went into one of the rooms and found them, or like say I was staying there and I woke up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, you know, hey, who was that chick I saw earlier? I got knocking her door. See where she's at.
I read this and I couldn't figure out the technology behind it. But he had a set of silent alarms on people's room doors.
Yeah.
Where when they'd open the door and start moving around. He, from a center location, would be able to know that people were moving around, but it wasn't like a string with a bell on it or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, there's a set of silent alarms inside the hotel. How do they work? Mm. If anyone out there can tell us, info@thoseconspiracyguys.com. If you know, like,
how did Holmes's
alarm system work? Like?
But he knew when people were moving around in the hotel.
Yeah.
Good God.
It's madness.
So he almost had like a Freddy or Jason ability to just appear wherever you were, and even if you ran from him. And hid somewhere.
You open
a room.
The door and it's a brick wall. And
but even if you found a room to hide in, he'd know which room you got into and just like walk straight to that room. His feet would appear as like a little silhouette under the door.
Dun, dun.
And he'd just stop and you'd be like,
dun, 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 dun.
Does he know I'm in here?
Whoa, 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 whoa.
And then next thing you just hear the door lock and you go, why is he locking the door? And then you hear a vent clack just beside you on the wall.
That's it?
Oh
man.
Fuck.
Yeah, that's fucked.
That's
and he's
so dark.
He'd be there to he'd have like
chasing people down the hallways and shit.
He'd have like a tin can on the end of a string talking to Pitezel in the basement just going, "Turn on number 31."
Oh Jesus.
That's fucked up, man.
Oh, that's
so like the murder methods were
varied
and wild.
And that's just like what we know from the structures that were in place. People that he,
these
like,
are photographs of the structures and
after the police kind of discovered things. Like, but if he just like walked into someone's room and locked himself in there with them, how he manually murdered them, I mean, is anybody's guess what he was actually doing to people. And as well as his furnace and his incinerators in the basement, he also had vats of acid and pits of lime.
Oh, that'll do it.
For dissolving
for getting rid of the
pesky biological
bones
matter.
And skin and all. Yeah,
for anything. Yeah, anything he couldn't sell.
And
had
it's
to be
all
dissolved completely.
It's all like sealed so that people couldn't smell anything. They're like, this is the smelliest hotel in America.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking hell. Like, that's serious forethought.
Yeah.
Genius level forethought. Mad.
Super dark.
So he kept killing. He was killing a lot of people in this hotel, right?
Yep, he's killing his staff, who he mandatorily took out insurance policies on. For their safety, if they had an accident in the hotel or something, the hotel was the beneficiary, should God they be damn. Here. So he could
pay, like a poison
he told
accident.
Them so he could pay out to them if anything happened to them. He's yeah. like, it's just easier to set it up this way. I'll get paid the money in. I'll support your family if you get hurt in the hotel. But really, he just started murdering his own employees. He was murdering guests coming through for the World Fair. And he was murdering ladies he would seduce and bring to the hotel.
Sure, that's
he would go out and he would go out and find ladies to
talk to
seduce
them.
And bring them and kill them.
Awkward.
Mm.
That is the walk of shame of death.
Yes.
The walk of shame of death. So he had over 200 murders in that. Like he didn't confess to 200, but it was estimated 200 people died by his hand.
Yes,
that is mad. And Poitel was obviously like complicit in all of these murders as well.
He probably would have known most of them.
Fucking hell! There's only so long you can do that though before you get busted, right? Like
eventually,
it's gonna
the heat will come down, and the heat did come down on him pretty hard. He in 1892 he made a trip to Boston where he met a woman named Minnie Williams, and she was a member of a wealthy railroad family, and he was under one of his aliases, Henry Gordon. And he began a long distance relationship with her, writing love letters back and forth. And in February 1893, she moves into the hotel just as the World's Fair starts. Right. She moves into the hotel to work as his intern, personal stenographer, which is just a cover for her to be able to like be in his office all the time, all day. And it's what she told her family back in Boston.
Mm.
I'm going to learn how to be a stenographer. Let me go do this. And she goes off and does it. He then charms her, convinces her that he'll leave his wife and that he'll marry her.
His second wife.
Yes, his second wife. He's just like living in their house in Wilmette and like never comes to the hotel. Every time he comes to the hotel in the morning, his wedding ring goes off and he's a different guy. Yeah, and
that's a lot of fucking lies to live up to.
He's got a lot of personalities, a lot of different identities, everything on the go. So like he's H.H. Holmes to everyone in the hotel and that to his wife, but he's Henry Gordon to this Minnie Williams that's now living in the hotel with him. Where again he'd move his lovers into the hotel with him because that's where he could be his different person.
Yeah,
and
they'd have their own room. And
he gets her. This is a really sick thing. He convinces her to get her sister Annie down from Boston. And the reason he wants this is because her and Annie jointly own a property in Fort Worth, Texas. And he wants this property and he needs both of them to sign it over to him.
In an insurance scam type pharmacy
husband
deal.
Sure, what
deal.
He's telling them. Jesus. But they come in, they sign it over to him and then he signs it over to Ben Poitel to distance himself from the deal.
Right.
But he still keeps control of it.
So Igor owns the place
in
Texas,
Fort Worth, Texas.
And the two sisters are living in the murder hotel.
Yes. And the two Williams sisters
this
who own this place
too
in Fort Worth,
to be
Texas.
True for,
yes.
Yeah.
So what happens once they sign the stuff over?
I'd say they probably die in a mysterious and crazy way, right?
They did indeed. Police,
that's just a guess, like.
Yeah, police found scratches, claw, like fingernail scratches and a shoe print from Annie Williams from inside the bank vault. So it would seem that he locked her inside the bank vault and suffocated her.
Right.
And they found Minnie Williams' jewellery inside the furnace in his office. So how he killed her, we've no idea, but we know that...
she got the dirt.
Oh, her hair and stuff was found inside the furnace as well, so we know that he probably stuffed her inside the furnace, chopped her up and burned her.
And this is after he was arrested and stuff?
This is only after he was arrested, this was found. Right. But them disappearing and their family wondering where the hell they had gone is what kind of brings the heat down on him.
So when he's arrested for like a murder, like a murder charge, he's suspected of murder, right? Like, because that seems like to be the crime of... The
top crime that he's running here, yeah. A lot of insurance scams. No, unfortunately, what he's actually arrested for is wrangling a horse.
For fuck's sake.
Mm. Yeah, he runs down to Fort Worth, Texas with Poitel and Poitel's wife and five kids.
To try and get the whole on the building.
This was his plan to run now. If he's done up to 200 murders, the Williams sisters was his way of getting away.
Right.
He sees them as a way out.
So he's willing to walk away from a whole hotel.
Oh, absolutely. As long as he can build a new something in Fort Worth, Texas and just go again.
Brilliant. So and he's left the hotel then to run on its own with the staff and they don't
know
anything about
and
all of
that. Yeah, Packing Williams is the caretaker running the place. And
I'm surprised he didn't burn it down for the insurance money.
Yeah. I wonder why he never thought of that.
Mm.
Maybe he couldn't. It was like too precious to him.
Yeah.
His amazing murder
memories.
Hotel. Yeah. But or maybe he didn't have time. Maybe he left pretty quickly. Because him and Poitel and Poitel's family just head down to Fort Worth, Texas. He can't seem to get any good scams going down in Fort Worth, Texas. He doesn't really know anybody. And maybe people are a bit more skeptical of the city boys.
I'd say those Texans are pretty savvy.
Yeah. So he gets caught doing some horse wrangling. And then goes on the run again because he doesn't want to meet justice. He's very afraid to meet justice in Texas.
Hmm.
So in January...
Texas don't fuck around with justice, right?
They really don't. But this is really where the end comes. Oh, he does pick up, by the way, in 1894, he picks up his third wife, Georgina Yoke, in Denver, Colorado.
So on the way to Texas, he stops off in Colorado
and gets a wife. Woman. Yeah.
Jesus, okay.
On the way. Because he's like, I'm going to become a new man. I'm going to become like blah, blah, blah. This. Marry me. And be
so
my wife.
So he's left. So he's left Myrtle in Chicago.
Yes.
He has another one in New Hampshire with a kid.
Yes, it's Clara.
Oh my God. Right. And then he has a third wife and they're on
in
the
Denver,
way.
Denver, Colorado. She's staying in Denver, Colorado.
Oh, she just stays there and he marries her for the crap. Right.
He married her and said, I'm coming back for you. Which he does come back for. He travels. His downfall really begins in St. Louis, Missouri, where he meets a fella named Marion Hedgepeth.
What the fuck is with these names?
I don't know which one's some of these names. These people have strange names. He's an
Winthorpe. And Pierpoint and all these names that aren't around anymore.
I don't know where people, I don't know where they get these names. For instance, his parents were named Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodette Page Price.
Theodette. That's like Theodore, the feminine of Theodore. Right?
Oh, Theodette's the woman. Oh, I got confused there. Okay, right. Man. That was his mother. Okay,
good
never
names,
mind.
Good names.
Yeah, people had crazy fucking names back then.
So he has, what did you say, Malapom Crapalapidus?
Marion Hedgepeth.
That's the one.
Famous outlaw and train robber. And he sets up again one of his insurance scams with him. He's in jail for a day in St. Louis, Missouri for selling stolen goods for fraudulent stuff. And he's talking to Marion Hedgepeth and he sets up a deal with him to work with Hedgepeth's kind of crooked lawyer, a fella named Jephthah Howe. Yeah, I know.
It sounds like you're making this shit up. Go on.
No, I'm not.
Go on.
The scam goes through, and of course, H.H. Holmes fails to pay Hedgepeth.
Right.
He's still in the James at the time. That will come back to bite him in the ass later.
Yeah, I'd say that a prolific train robber and career criminal is not going to fuck around with some insurance scammer.
Exactly. Mm. He heads back to Philadelphia with Peitzel, where he knows more people and can run more scams than he can in Texas. So in Philadelphia, Peitzel decides, Holmes decides now it's time for Peitzel to fake his death. Holmes is I'm sick of faking my death.
Holmes
fake your goddamn
like,
death.
Like 8 times now.
Exactly.
And he's changed his name a bunch and he's like, I like H.H. Holmes as a name. It's time for you to take the bullet, Peitzel.
Exactly. And the heat's coming down from Texas as well because of the horse wrangling deal and from all the other little stops he's had along the way.
And all his wives.
And all his different wives. So he's saying, hey, Peitzel, if you're going to be my proper psychic, you need to change your name. You need to not be you anymore because this isn't going well. So Peitzel eventually agrees. He gets set up as B.F. Perry, a successful inventor who would be maimed and killed in a laboratory explosion.
Brilliant.
After having set up his $10,000 life insurance policy. Just having set it up.
So that seems like a pretty foolproof plan then.
All you need to do is get a cadaver that looks a bit like Peitzel.
Yeah. But he wouldn't have access to them now because he doesn't work in a hospital, university, or...
He hasn't had any medical ties for a good few years.
Hasn't gone back. Like, he can't go back to the hotel to find somebody.
Where's he
going to
find a body that looks just like Ben Peitzel?
He could just use, like, Peitzel's body.
His body? You mean kill him?
Yeah. Could he do that?
He did do that, yeah.
Oh, fuck's sake. He did. Can you imagine that? Like, being Ben Peitzel, being like, sure, Henry, I'll help you out anyway. And he just, like, gets a chloroform cloth over the mouth. Like, that is not cool.
Yeah, chloroforms him and sets him on fire.
Fucking hell. And then obviously claims the insurance.
And he claims the insurance. And then goes to Peitzel's wife and says, Peitzel has all the money. He's travelled on ahead of us to London.
Yeah, that's...
He wants me to get you out.
This is the worst part
of the
story.
Didn't just ditch the family.
Yeah, this is
could
the worst
have,
part
could have,
of the
story. But didn't.
Just left that family with the wife and 5 kids to just wander and you know, those 5 kids who grew up and go, my daddy just walked out on me one day. Mm. Said he was going out to buy a pack of cigarettes, never came home. And instead, Holmes came to that family and went, your daddy has gone to London with a bunch of money. Come with me and we'll all go to London.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ended up like leaving a trail of dead kids' bodies behind him, like Hansel and Gretel with breadcrumbs in the forest on his way to Canada.
Yeah. He splits the family
really
into
man.
3 middle kids and then the mother and the 2 oldest kids. And he does this weird thing where he travels up to Canada with them, where he's traveling with one group and then leaves them in the town, travels back to the other group, brings them a different way, leaves them in a different town, and just keeps moving them up together.
And leaving one behind every time as a dead body. Like.
But then at the last, up in Detroit, he ends up like bringing the middle 3 kids just by himself up into Canada, up into Toronto, where he ends up murdering the 2 young girls. And then later...
In Toronto.
Yeah, in Toronto. And then later comes back to Detroit where he murders Ben Peitzel's son.
Can you imagine me and Ben Peitzel's son like waiting in an apartment in Detroit for H.H. Holmes to come back? After bringing your 2 sisters up to Canada. Like, that is a lonely, like, 48 hours or whatever it took to get, like, fuck. You're thinking, should I just bolt? Like, I should be out of here, right? like, this is not good. Where's mom? Where's my brothers and sisters? Like, that is
dark.
To convince the child to stay there, like, no, don't go anywhere.
Keep bringing them with you for no particular reason.
Like, for no reason.
Maybe to, like, hide yourself. Oh, don't look like a single man traveling now.
Yeah,
but other
than a single man traveling is less suspicious than like a single man with three teenage kids that aren't his or don't look like him.
And would tell people they're not. Oh, this is a friend of our dad's. His name is H.H. Holmes. He owns a hotel in Chicago. Like,
yeah, Jesus,
it seems so weird. There's something twisted in him.
Well, the thing is, like, Toronto was his downfall. Like, if whatever you're doing in America, but you don't fuck around with them Canadians with the shit.
Not them MC, those mounted police. Yeah, man.
Them lads will eat, like, dog shit and, like, lick the air and find you in
and
half
tell
an
when your ass had a cup of coffee.
Yeah, you're like, this guy likes throwing bread to ducks. How did you know that? His shit tastes like bread and ducks. Like, they're magic, it seems to me. Like Juice South. Remember Juice South?
Juice South?
Yeah. Where that...
Oh, Juice South. Yeah.
Not like...
Oh, I thought you said Juice Out. It was like, Juice Out.
I'm going down to Florida. No, it's not. It's Juice...
Due South.
And there's like a mounted police, and he comes down and he works with
Chicago,
like, in Chicago
street
So, like, in Philadelphia there was a detective called Frank Geyer.
Ooh.
And he was tracking Holmes, and he tracked him all the way to Toronto. And in the murdering of those kids in Toronto, like, he left behind evidence.
Uh-huh.
And Geyer found it, and it was his unraveling.
Yeah.
The poor child, Pytel's son, was found in the chimney of the rented house that
he was living in.
That they were living in Detroit, where he was waiting for Holmes to come back from. So, like, he killed the child and folded him up, put him up a chimney.
Oh, fucking,
like, that's fucked up. After him waiting there for 2 days or whatever, like, that's fucked, right?
That's so dark.
And at this point, like, private detectives were called in. Like, Toronto, like, this is where it's all falling apart for Holmes. He's on the run. He's like, I have a lot of kids here for no reason.
He has police chasing him. He has Pinkerton private detectives chasing him.
So he abandons the Toronto plan and he bounces to Boston.
Oh.
So it's down south. And like, who knows where the mother and the other two kids are at this point.
Just left them.
Just left them, right?
Yeah.
And Hedge Pet and a bunch of Pinkerton officers have followed him now to Boston.
Aha.
And he's arrested on the 17th of November, 1894, before he was about to, like, leave the country.
Oh.
Presumably to go to England with all of his...
Oh, London, yeah. Maybe he was going to
his dollars.
London. Yeah.
But, like, if you were going to fucking escape to another country and you had a bunch of money, like, why would you drag those kids around and leave a trail of bodies behind you for someone to catch you just before you get to leave?
And he's dragging his third wife around at the time, too. She's, I just say, they were, like, in three parties.
She must have been complicit in it as well as Pycelle or whatever.
Well, no, she was brought on a different trip to Boston and left there and told, wait there for me while he brought the kids up to Toronto.
That is, like, the shittest game of Risk
right.
ever. It's like, I moved two from here to there. And also then the crimes that he was committing in Texas came back to bite him on the ass.
Indeed, he was only arrested for the horse wrangling.
Yeah.
But because he was so fearful of standing trial in Texas for anything, probably did a lot of murders in Texas as well, he didn't want to go back for.
Yeah.
Because he was so afraid of having to go back to Texas, he ended up copping to the insurance scam in Pennsylvania for Pytel. Right. But some detectives in Pennsylvania had actually worked out that his story about buying a corpse and then bringing it to the fire and setting it on fire and didn't match what the coroner found when he got to the body, which was a fresh body that had been set on fire.
Right. So if it was a cadaver, it already would have had to go through, like,
rigor mortis
and the muscles would have, like, burned in a different way, and there would have been less fat on the body to burn and stuff like that, so it would have burned at a lower temperature. So they found it was a fresh body.
Yes.
Fuck.
And
so
he was
like,
lying.
I confess to the insurance scam.
Yes.
And then the Pinkertons were like, and what about that murder?
Yeah, and he's like, what murder? And I got
fuck,
him.
Man.
Nobody said murder. You just told us.
So when he got strung up then...
Literally.
Yeah. In 1894, the Chicago detectives, like, went to the hotel after he was arrested.
Yes, the World's Fair
and
Hotel.
And then it all started to come out about the gravity of...
Yeah,
like, the scale of what he was doing.
The caretaker manager, Pat Quinlan, then began to, like, reveal... Because he wasn't doing murders there, but he began to reveal, hey, man, there's a lot of weird rooms in here that I didn't know about.
A lot, like, of doors are brick walls.
A lot of doors are brick walls. There's a lot of bits that smell like blood that probably shouldn't smell like blood.
So let's go through then the actual things that were
found
in the hotel.
Yeah. So when the Chicago PD break into this hotel, what they find is there's various human hair samples and a female footprint were found in the clay that surrounded the lime pits in the basement. They couldn't identify any of the hair samples, obviously, back in the 1890s. There was numerous human bones and empty poison bottles, so the kind of pharmacy stuff he was ordering in.
I guess there was, like, bodies left over in the furnace and in the acid pits.
Bits of bones in the acid pits and the furnaces. There was bones of a little girl that he'd killed, who was a daughter of one of his lovers. And then the bloody dress of that said lover also, that was confirmed by her husband.
And I suppose the rooms that he was cutting up all the bodies to get the bones and organs out of was just like...
stinky.
An abattoir or whatever. Yeah.
They found piles of human bones, piles of bloody claws, piles of animal bones. So he was still killing animals at this period of time. Yeah. They found fingernail marks.
You stick to what you know, right?
Yeah. They found fingernail scratches behind doors and in the bank vault. And in the rooms with no doors. Firemen actually went underground, discovered there was a tunnel in the basement that led out under the street.
To the lime pits out in the backyard.
No. To a sealed room that, when they cracked into it, was just a pit filled with oil.
And what would he do with that? Like, drown people in the oil?
We don't know what happened, because apparently a janitor who was down with the firemen in the tunnel lit a match to see what was going
on. What the fuck? Hey boys, this smells like oil.
The fumes ignited and blew the guys out of the tunnel.
Fuck.
So whatever evidence in there was destroyed, but they never bothered draining the oil pit to see how many bones, I guess, were at the bottom. How many people, maybe alive, he just brought down there and threw into an oil pit.
So he was doing like the woolly mammoth type death, where it's like, and you go into the oil pit there with you.
So like 20 years later, you could dig them out and reminisce about
like
that
the
time.
Like the La Brea tar pits or whatever.
Mm. But then he bricked it up. Fuck, but they found kind of all of these horror rooms. And like I said, this is where the story comes from. This is what we know about all these horror rooms. The actual details of how we murder people, no idea really.
Did he
strangulation? Did he like to
So where did they
people?
Get the 200 number? Like, obviously there was only... like 10, there's only 10,
it's to do
like
with the amount of missing
found,
people
right?
reported to have come through the hotel. It's to do with like going through the hotel's guest book list and being able to verify people that are still alive, basically, off the hotel list and that aren't. So very hard number to track down. Holmes, actually, when he was finally arrested and convicted, he confessed to 30 murders.
Right.
Now, 27 of those people they could confirm as having been murdered.
And the other three?
The other three were found alive and well.
Why did he confess to 30 then?
Well, he confessed to, three people that were alive. He said, I killed these 30 people, and when they checked, three of them were still alive.
So, the way that the police were doing it was, H.H. Holmes confessed to the murder.
Yes.
And then they'd check on the sign-in sheet in the hotel.
Make sure they
were
if they
had died or not.
And then try and track them down.
If they were there or not.
Yes.
And then if they had signed in and their name was there, they'd check, are they alive? No, they're dead. Okay. But they found the three names that he had given.
Yes, were still alive. So they're obviously, in a way it seems weird. Maybe he thought Ben Poitzel killed him or something. Like, in a way, names he knew that stayed in the hotel that for some reason Holmes, I guess, thought would be dead.
Him. Yeah.
Or that if the police checked, he'd find out they were dead and murdered in the hotel, but they weren't.
Maybe there was like a breakdown in communication between the person doing the killing and the...
Maybe he didn't do all the killing. Yeah, 200 is a lot of killings in a space of 3 years.
Well, I mean, it's one every... 4 days, like, or whatever.
Yeah, I suppose. You could do them two or three at a time.
Yeah. I think that it could be a thing where he was, like, selling the privilege of murder, maybe. And
to people, yeah. Like a Eli Roth type situation.
Yeah, he could have sold, like, or a hostel type thing where you sell the privilege. He's like, I want money. You see, for me, H.H. Holmes wasn't, like, a murderer.
Yeah.
The murder wasn't the thing.
Yeah.
It was money was the thing.
Oh, yeah.
And murder
yeah.
was the way to get it.
Yeah, he seemed
he was
less
the only
sex.
One
he wasn't a sexy-driven murder. He was a money-driven murder.
He commodified murder.
Yes,
he capitalized
totally.
Murder. And if you're like, yeah, well, look at it. I don't really like... you never work a day in your life if you enjoy your job. And his job was insurance scams, but he needed dead bodies to do that. So he's like, oh, well, dead bodies. I couldn't imagine him chopping them up going like... like he was like...
Yeah.
Like loving chatting people up, going, this is great, and I get money for it too. It wasn't for like a sexual gratification or anything. But like, it seems that 200 is an awful lot. The scenario where H.H. Holmes would sell the privilege to rich Chicago or US businessmen to say, alright, I'm going to get a girl, she's going to be in here, she's coming from like, you know, Arkansas, she's travelled up to Chicago and she's, you know, going to be make her fortune in Chicago at the World's Fair, and you're like, if you want to kill her, it's going to cost you like $5,000 or whatever. And people have paid that. And then he said, okay, you know, Sally, Jesse, Raphael, come up from Arkansas and she's staying in this hotel. And he knows that name. So when he's confronted then in Boston, he's like, Yeah, okay. There was Benjamin Peitzel. There was Mugrug Huffafluff. Or whatever those fucking made up 1890s names. And he's like, and Sally Raphael. And it's like, oh, she's not dead. And he's like, well, I got paid. So that she'd be dead. Do you know that kind of a way, like, it seems plausible. If he's naming out names that he didn't kill. And there's 170 others that are presumed dead, like missing presumed dead.
Yes.
That had been liquefied.
That he couldn't give names for. Like, that he couldn't work out.
Yeah.
But that the police were tracing.
It's heavy, man.
Like, think about that's an interesting thing you just said. Think about it like this. In August 1895, and remember, he gets convicted in October, so he's in the trial now in August for the trial for Benjamin Peitzel. This single murder that they've copped him on.
So that's the only thing they got him on.
Got him on an insurance scam, and that's single murder they've proven so far.
Like 200 people.
But they're only searching the hotel now at this time in August 1895. They're looking through the hotel. And while the hotel is being investigated...
Oh, while it's being investigated?
Yes. It burns down.
Wow. And Peitzel is dead.
Peitzel is dead.
Holmes is in custody.
In custody. So up in Boston.
There was a third man.
There's somebody else involved.
Fuck.
Well, maybe more, because two men are seen going up to the hotel, going inside, and then running away just before explosions started a fire on the inside that gutted the entire inside.
I didn't read that, man.
Mm.
Really?
100%.
Amazing. So the lads were finding all these like hair and teeth and jewelry and shit.
Chicago police are investigating, going, well, as soon as this guy's trial is finished and thing, we're going to go up there and prosecute him for this shit.
And obviously there was like concerned parties who were like, they better not find my
that murder I paid
my,
for
my sex towel or whatever. Fuck. So two guys went in and set incendiary devices like Joe Pesci like stapling paraffin soaked cloth to the tissue to the roof of the basement of the
and
hotel.
Make sure the place was gutted by the fire, kind of fire.
I saw the fire. I knew there was a fire, but I thought it was like, oh, you know, a cop lit a match. It's like, hey, there's a lot of, this place smells like petrol.
Like, closed down hotel, crime scene.
I saw that it went on fire and every floor collapsed into itself and it went down into the it was in the basement of the hotel. Like, the whole thing collapsed.
Yeah, but that's what, like, he had his death rooms in every floor, basement, everything. Yeah. And every floor was gutted by the fire.
Boom. Jesus.
It was leveled. The Joe Pesci thing you say is gutted. Not even the building was leveled. The insides were gutted out by the fire.
Oh, man.
That's how, like a Joe Pesci, that's how well the fire was set. Didn't damage anything around it, just everything inside the building.
Also, the outside was all still castle.
The outside was still, that had to be knocked down like in 1938 so they could build a post office there.
Wow.
So there's a post office there now if you go there today. But
a haunted post office.
But the building remained, and a gutted, empty, burnt out building remained there in 1938.
Oh, fuck, man. That is, I didn't see
like
about
big,
that.
Big giant haunted house.
That's totally Lynn, like,
somebody
guilty.
Somebody else is involved. Oh, totally someone else
so
is
who's
involved.
Around, who is elite
the
at
only way
time?
It could be if, he pays a couple of lackeys from his prison cell? Because nobody else is with him. Like, he doesn't have his wife or his family's like, standing by him.
Yeah, well, none of them are going to be visiting because he owes him a load of alimony. He's one in Denver, one in New Hampshire, and one in Chicago.
Yeah.
Maybe the Chicago wife came in and he's like, you got to tell Billy and Humphrey to burn the place down or something.
He wasn't known as someone to have a lot of close people. Only Benjamin Peitzel, and he was his lackey, and he had a sort of a lackey when he was in medical school that he did the insurance scams with. But that's it. They're the only. But he murdered Peitzel by this stage.
Did anyone get paid from the insurance on the hotel burning down?
Not that I know.
It could have been another insurance scam, and it may be not as insidious as we think, which is like a cabal of businessmen murderers were paying homes for the privilege.
Let's see how you see this then. After he was convicted, but before he was hanged, and when he began to start maybe babbling a little bit and writing memoirs about what had gone on, a fellow named William Randolph Hearst, I don't know if you
heard
that name before in many episodes that we've done, came in and paid him $7,500, which
to shut the fuck up, like,
is $215,000 in today's money.
God damn.
It's a decent chunk.
So, $7,500 is like almost a quarter of a million now. So when he was like pulling in $20,000 life insurance policies, he was like, that's a half a million.
Yeah. That's how he built
a hotel
from the ground up. Like, in those days, everyone should have been running insurance scams.
What are you talking about? You're taking cadavers that are already dead and just fucking them into like a car that blew up. Oh, man.
Unless he knew some pretty high up people in the financial business world
who were like,
approving his insurance scams.
Let me tell you, Henry, if you do this, I'll split the money with you. That is so. William Randolph Hearst,
yes, came in,
is implicated,
and bought exclusively his story.
God
and
damn.
Hearst was his, through his newspapers and publications, was where his story was publicized. But the story is a complete mess. The one that was printed as his story was that he only killed 30 people, and that most of the stuff didn't happen, and that it was all down to H.H. Holmes. That was really what Hearst's publications did. They told people that Holmes had been sort of, I guess, taken over by the devil. And the devil had inspired him to kill.
Yeah, of course you're going to turn it into a religious thing. Like, but that's bananas. So he was afraid that it was going to be...
I think he was afraid that Holmes might have said something. If there were other people involved in all the murdering, the 200 murders, maybe whoever was involved with that was afraid Holmes was going to say something. And for whatever reason, then William Randolph Hearst came in and bought a silence.
Wow. For a lot of money at the time.
Mm.
That is mental. So Holmes was like convicted of the murder of Poitzel.
Yeah. Sentenced to die by hanging. But then the hotel burned down and there's no more evidence of anything else. He's not talking because he signed this exclusivity deal.
But he still admitted to 30 murders.
He admitted to 30 murders until William Randolph Hearst came in and got exclusivity on a story.
And so he couldn't even...
No, he could talk to the police, but he just suddenly decided to stop talking to the police at that stage.
Okay, okay.
And then the police had no choice but to hang him for the one murder he'd been convicted of.
So he was hanged then in before like the turn of the century.
Yeah.
So he got to see none of those technological advances. He got to see none of the propaganda that was, you know, proliferated through the whole United States at the turn of the century. Like, I'd say he'd be a really good guy to keep alive through all of that. Like, if you're talking about manipulation...
Oh, if he stayed in jail like Charlie Manson, you mean?
No, but stayed in jail and then, like, after 30 years got out, like, and it's 1920 and he gets released and he's an elderly Holmes who's had, like, 20 years to make up a plan. Like, can you imagine, like...
Jack the Ripper
like,
in the future.
Holmes and Bernays, like, smashed together in that time.
Oh, my
like,
God.
He was a guy who, you know...
He was a scheming, like
scheming, powerful,
clever person,
yeah. That's mad, man.
He could have ran in pretty high circles.
So, the date he died, 7th of May, 1896.
Gone. Just missed out on that next century, that turn of the century action.
He didn't just, like, get hung, though.
Oh, no?
He did suffer a small piece.
Oh, that's good.
When they pulled the trap or kicked the chair or whatever way they do it, normally you fall and the force of the foot and a half drop will crack your neck and, you know, you die.
You're gone instant.
Pretty instantaneously. His didn't, and it took him 20 minutes to strangle to death in front of an audience that sat at his execution.
Briefly watching.
Like, that's pretty... There is an audio of interviews of him you can get on YouTube, or we might put it in this at some point. But he's like, yeah, I committed 30 murders. And then at one point he says, I was born with the devil in me. Like, that's an excuse for him killing all those people. Like, that's
how Hearst put it, yeah.
Yeah, he knows. But it seems to be, like, Hearst kind of turned him into a legend, a little piece in the publications, the Hearst publications. Like,
well, like we said, he was the first, documented and majorly publicized serial killer in U.S. history.
He was feared, though. Like, when they buried him, like, his last request before he died was to be buried 10 feet deep and in, a concrete coffin.
Oh,
presumably because I think maybe he felt the guilt of all the bodies that he killed, or maybe he actually believed, like, if you don't do this, my evil will rise.
The devil will leave out of his body.
I wonder how haunted that post office is.
that's the Englewood post office in Illinois.
If anyone is in Illinois,
pop on by the Englewood post office. Although it's probably a famous landmark there.
Yeah.
Probably everyone knows that's where the Holmes hotel was.
Maybe so.
I would imagine.
Well, that's the end of the first episode of Those Conspiracy Guys True Crime. That's H.H. Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful story told one beautifully by Paul.
CEO of the WWE.
Yes. Join us again for our next one in 2 weeks' time. It'll also be advertised on Spin, and for those of you coming from Spin, welcome. We are Those Conspiracy Guys.
We are.
And if anything that we've talked about on the episode tickles your fancy and you want to talk more about it,
you have any evidence?
Or
we might solve one of these unsolved murders that we're going to be talking about, that'd be cool too.
Or if you're one of the descendants of H.H. Holmes' kids from New Hampshire or
Denver. You got some
Denver,
stuff in the know?
Get in contact with us. The email is info@thoseconspiracyguys.com. We're on facebook.com/thoseconspiracyguys. We're on Twitter @tconspiracyguys. Instagram/thoseconspiracyguys. We have a YouTube channel that will have loads of stuff about H.H. Holmes and about loads of other crimes and all of our other episodes. Loads of different sources, interviews, documentaries, and little videos from us. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/thoseconspiracyguys, and you can show $1 or $2. And we have loads of exclusive videos, secret footage, behind the scenes talk, outtakes from the shows, and you get first access to all the YouTube videos before anybody else. There's also a live show that goes on once a month if you're a Patreon subscriber, and you just basically get all the TCG goodies before anybody else gets their greasy fingers on them. That's it for our first true crime episode. Hope you liked it. Please let us know what you think. We are Those Conspiracy Guys. I'm Gordo.
I'm Paul.
And join us next time. Goodbye.
Bye.